you scream, we all scream for Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com. I'm Amelia Dalton, and you better get ready, my friends. We are headed straight into the clouds, through the deep blue sea, and right on over to the hot, dusty sands of the Mojave Desert. Why? Because we can. Because we have the right enclosure for our electronics. That's right. A lot of you out there are developing designs that need to go into the harshest of environments, and I'm here to help. Well, with a little assistance from a team from LCR Embedded Technologies. So get that jetpack latched on tight, your wetsuit comfortably close, and your spelunking gear polished and ready to go. We're going in.
All right, my guests today are Kenneth Brown, Donald Germany, and Janice Corteza from LCR Embedded Systems. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, we're happy to be here in the Big Easy with you.
Excellent. So first off, for my audience who may not know, tell me, what is LCR Embedded Systems all about?
Okay, LCR Embedded Systems split off from another company called LCR Electronics that was founded in 1985 and made EMI filters, small electronics components. It split off in around 2013. And what we are is essentially an electronics packaging house. People come to us, they need a lot of processing. They need a lot of processing in a very rugged package that's going to go underwater in the air, that's going to be carried by somebody actually in the field, because we do a lot of military and defense.
Okay.
And it's our job to get all of those components and get them to play well together in one large electronic enclosure.
Okay, cool.
We have a tendency to be regarded as, this is a weird metaphor, but that strange surgeon that everybody goes to in the world, the one person who could separate conjoined triplets or something. We're the ones that do all those hard, scary problems that a lot of other people can't necessarily deal with. They don't necessarily have the expertise.
Okay.
What that gives us is an amazing awareness of the broad landscape of the different kinds of problems that these different companies can confront. And thanks to that, as well as being a custom house, because most of our work is custom, we're beginning to develop a series of standard products as well. Because after you see so many different problems that our customers have to face, customers like Boeing and Raytheon, it gives you a really good awareness of what the broad market needs, what kinds of problems are out there, and what types of challenges need to be dealt with.
Right.
So we're going to be using that expertise, leveraging it to develop our own line of standard products as well.
Excellent. All right, Ken, you're on deck here. Now, let's talk about VPX. There seems to be a lot of I/O challenges inherent here. What do you think are the biggest challenges in this space?
Well, primarily the history of the bus networks. My reference point would be VME or maybe advanced TCA. People were used to having, even if they had 21 slots in a chassis, they could plug any of their boards into any of those slots and they would function. In ATCA, you maybe had two types of slots where you had your switch slot and your node slots. And as long as you plugged into the boards into any slot that they were compatible with, they would work. With VPX, you have, as was pointed out earlier in our meeting, over 81 different slot profiles that are potentially there in a VPX backplane.
Yeah.
So the board you're plugging in has to be matched up with that profile or you will not get the full functionality.
Sure.
That change, while it offers a ton of options and flexibility and power to the end user potentially, it also offers a new set of challenges where they have to manage those slot configurations like they never have before.
Right. Okay, so Donald, you guys just released a new family of COTS-based enclosures. So what does this buy me as an engineer? And what are the challenges and complications you're trying to address here?
We have a 2U, 3U, and 4U rack mount set of systems that we've just released. We're designed predominantly for a compact PCI. Base CPU boards, but can be adapted for VME and or VPX if necessary. The 2U box and the 3U box have a common 2U interface for the compute blades, but then the 3U has a 1U add-on module that gives you I.O.
Okay.
For hard drives, it can be removable, and a DVD drive. You can get that in the 2U as well, but you have to give up one of your compact PCI slots.
Okay.
For the same, 2U also gives you redundant power supply. If you want a single power supply, these are removable supplies. You can use some of that space for I/O. So it's pretty configurable. The 4U gives you all of that on the side of the box, so you have more space to put your I/O. We also offer an hour meter in the box, which allows you to see how long your product has been in running.
Nice.
For cooling and maintenance purposes.
Sure, yeah.
And the boxes also offer closures and doors on the front. A lot of compact PCI and VME systems are front accessible, so you always see them open. Well, we have an option where you can actually close that off, so it's nice looking. You can brand it, and you can put a smoked glass door on it so you can see things that are going on inside without it seeing the things going on inside,
right.
If you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of flexibility in there. And they do come with RTM support.
Okay.
To bring out I/O from boards that have RTM availability. We just want to provide a family of products that's flexible, that gets some features that some other customers may not put out there.
All right, Janice, now it's time for your off-the-cuff question.
Okay.
I heard that you guys here at LCR, at least your team here with me today, has a bit of an artsy DNA. You are a hobby musician and started playing, 19th century style flute?
Yes.
Now, how did you get involved with that?
I'm actually still, not all that sure. I've been a musician since I was a little kid. I started with piano, as a lot of people do. I moved over to harp also because it's very similar to piano, but you're actually a little bit closer to the actual physics of the sound production, so it's a little bit more satisfying.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons why I picked up the flute is because, for want of a better way of putting it, I wanted to pick up an instrument that I could actually, if you know what I mean, pick up, like with one hand.
Right, a harp.
Yes. Playing piano and harp,
no.
It gets a little tiring playing furniture all the time.
Right.
But it's kind of nice to play something you can actually bring on an airplane with you. And one of the good things about the 19th century flute is that they were adopted by Irish folk musicians in the 19th century because they were rendered obsolete with the invention of the silver flute that everybody is familiar with in orchestras now. And folk musicians don't actually care if you play left-handed.
Huh.
You can play on either side. They don't care. Classical musicians are very particular about that.
Sure.
And as a left-hander, it's a lot more comfortable for me. So I just kind of picked it up, and I don't know.
That's
neat.
Awesome.
It's a lot of fun, and I'm really enjoying it. And we, as you observed, we have some artsy DNA here. Ken's son has just started trumpet lessons.
Oh.
Donald is your oldest or your next oldest is getting involved in filmmaking college. And even our CEO, Nissen Isakov, if anybody out there is into music, they may recognize the name Isakov. His son, Gregory Isakov, is a very, very well-known musician who's just finished a CD with the Colorado Symphony. So, yeah, we've got some artsy DNA. It helps with the creative problem solving.
I love it. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having us.
And now it's time for a little Kickstarter corner. My friends, have you ever wondered about the existence of UFOs? Sure, we've all heard for decades about spectral lights on the horizon, flashes of light that seem to zigzag in the sky, and even people being abducted by aliens. But what can we do about it? Well, other than researching the existence of exoplanets, strengthening our existing astronomical institutions, and finally getting a tourist into space, right? Because that's important. Speaking of which, did you know that the odds, as in betting odds, that Michael Jordan will be the first pro athlete in space via SpaceX's commercial moon landing is 7-1? 7-1. I mean, that's pretty good for good old MJ. Anyway, what are we going to do about those stinking aliens? Always buzzing our house, stealing our cattle, or our neighbors. Well, a new Kickstarter campaign by the name of UFO Cam Network is here to help. So, instead of all of us taking turns staring up at the sky for hours, why don't we put together a network of wireless and completely autonomous motion detection cameras pointed at the sky? Wouldn't that make much more sense? Well, UFO Cam Network would have you think so. The goal of this campaign is to deploy a public and scientific study on the anomalies in the sky with the participation from a community of researchers, scientists, UFO enthusiasts, and individuals who simply want to participate and learn more about these subjects. Well, that's me! Okay, so as you can undoubtedly imagine, cameras will be part of this equation. So this Kickstarter campaign wants to deploy fully independent, autonomous motion detection applications that can capture anomalies in the sky at any given location and simultaneously upload them to their public feed at www.ufocamnet.com. Okay, so sounds all fine and good. Right? Well, I mean, aren't we already kind of doing this in a lot of ways with current astronomy programs throughout the world? Okay, never mind that. Fine print time. It does say a little farther down in this Kickstarter campaign that this team is having a bit of trouble finding a cost-effective way to build the sheer number of cameras needed for this project, but they are working on a couple different prototypes, and that only one prototype is currently functional and fully operational with the UFO CamNet website and server backend. Okay. Maybe it's just a slow build or something. So, here's my question. Other than, where can I sign up? No, we'll get to that in a bit. How or who, for that matter, is going to review hours and hours of these video feeds to determine whether it's a Frisbee or a UFO? Is that a traffic helicopter? Or are alien overlords finally coming to roost? Or is that just John from down the street with another one of his drones that he'll undoubtedly lose in a tree in less than a week? See, there's absolutely nothing about the actual job of reviewing the material. They do say each capture is met with scrutiny and research to rule out any possibility of natural occurrences or human interference in the surrounding environment. Okay. That's great, but it still begs the question, is this a person scrutinizing the material? An embedded vision algorithm? Nope, no answers. And then, well, there's the cost. Researching UFOs ain't cheap, my friends. You're looking at about $1,000 for a UFO cam, complete with its own name and configuration, which can be set up in any location of your choice. Preferably not pointed at Quadcopter John's house. That guy. He's kind of a jerk. It will, according to this team at UFO CamNet, function autonomously, allowing it to operate, recharge, capture, and stream directly to the UFO CamNet servers completely on its own. And then, well, those servers. I did a little poking around at UFO CamNet, and it looks like there's this glowing orb in the sky in all of their feeds. Yeah, I'm not gonna send out that alien overlord signal just yet. It's kind of like the bat signal, right? But there's this glowing orb in all of their current feeds, and people have been telling me that it's this thing called the sun, but I can't vouch for that completely since I live in Portland, Oregon, and it's been quite a while since I've seen that glowing orb in person. People, it's been raining here forever. Okay, if you want to jump on this Kickstarter campaign, well, I've got a bridge to talk to you about. No, there won't actually be much of a line, see, because this campaign has netted about $0 so far. So there's that. If you're curious about this campaign, rather, of course, I've included a link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. Also, by clicking those links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of April 28th, 2017, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.